Of the stones which, as I said before, the high priest wore on his shoulders, they were sardonyxes, and I think it superfluous to explain their nature to those who already know it well. It happened that they shone, whenever God was present at the sacred rites, the one fastened on the right shoulder flashing out a radiance visible even to those standing farthest off, a brightness the stone did not have before. This is a marvel, indeed, to those who have not schooled their wisdom to belittle divine things, but I shall tell of something still more marvelous than this. Through the 12 stones which the high priest wears sewn upon his breastplate, God foretold victory to those about to go to war. For so great a radiance flashed from them, even before the army had set out, that the whole multitude knew that God was present to give aid, which is why the Greeks who honor our customs, since they can find no answer to this, call the breastplate the oracle. The oracle and the sardonyx, however, ceased to shine 200 years before I composed this account, because God was displeased at the transgression of the laws, a matter I shall discuss at a more fitting time. I now turn to the account that follows. When the tabernacle had been consecrated and the arrangements concerning the priests set in order, the people judged that God now shared their dwelling with them and turned to sacrifices and festivities, as though every expectation of misfortune had now been driven off. And desiring even better things to come, they made offerings to God, some in common and some individually, by tribes. The tribal chiefs, coming together two by two, each pair brought a wagon and two oxen. There were six of these in all, and they were used to convey the tabernacle on the journeys. In addition, each chief brought a bowl, a dish, and a censer, the censer capable of holding 10 derricks and full of incense. The dish and the bowl, which were of silver, together weighed 200 shekels, while the bowl alone contained 70, and both were full of fine flour mixed with oil, such as is used at the altar for the sacred rites. Each also brought a young bull, a ram, and a yearling lamb, whole and unblemished, to be burned entirely, and with them a young goat as an offering for the forgiveness of sins. Each of the chiefs also brought other sacrifices, called peace offerings, on each day, two oxen and five rams together with yearling lambs and kids. These chiefs sacrificed for 12 days, one on each day. Moses, meanwhile, no longer went up to Sinai, but entering the tabernacle learned from God both what was to be done and the ordering of the laws, laws that, being beyond ordinary human understanding, came to be preserved securely for all time, being held to be a gift of God, so that the Hebrews should never transgress any of them, neither in time of peace through indulgence, nor in time of war under compulsion. But on these matters I stop speaking here, having resolved to compose a separate treatise concerning the laws. For now, I shall touch briefly on a few points that concern purifications and sacred rites, since my account has in fact come round to the subject of sacrifices. There are two kinds of sacred rites. Of these, the one is performed by private individuals, the other by the whole people, and each takes place in two ways. In the one, the whole offering is wholly burned, and for this reason it has received this very name. The other is a thank offering, performed with feasting on the part of those who have sacrificed. I shall speak first of the former. A private individual offering a whole burnt sacrifice sacrifices an ox, a lamb, or a kid. These must be within their first year, though he is permitted to sacrifice oxen even when older, but all victims wholly burned must be male. When these have been slaughtered, the priests sprinkle the blood around the altar. Then, having cleansed the carcass, cut it into pieces, sprinkle it with salt, and lay it upon the altar, which is already piled with wood and burning with fire. The feet of the victims and the inward parts, after being thoroughly cleansed, they add to the rest to be likewise consecrated by fire, while the priests take the hides for themselves. Such is the manner of the whole burnt offering. As for those performing thank offerings, they sacrifice the same kinds of animals, but these must be whole and older than yearlings, males paired with females. Having sacrificed these, they redden the altar with the blood, and the kidneys, the caul, all the fat together with the lobe of the liver, and with these the tail of the lamb, they lay it on the altar. The breast and the right leg they give to the priests, and for 2 days the offerers feast on what remains of the meat. Whatever is left over they burn. Sacrifices are also offered for sins, and the manner of the priestly rite for sins is the same as already described. Those unable to afford full-grown victims bring two pigeons or turtle doves, one of which is burned whole for God, the other given to the priests to eat. I will speak more precisely about the sacrifice of these creatures in my work on sacrifices. A man who falls into sin through ignorance offers a yearling lamb or a female kid. The priest sprinkles the altar with its blood, not as in the first case, but only on the projecting corners, and the kidneys and the rest of the fat, together with the lobe of the liver, are laid on the altar. The priests take the hides and consume the meat that same day within the sanctuary, for the law does not allow it to be left until the morrow. A man who has sinned but is conscious of it himself with no one to convict him offers a ram, as the law directs. Its meat likewise the priests eat that same day within the sanctuary. Rulers who make atonement for their own offenses bring the same, but differ in that they present a bull or a male kid as their victim. The law requires that fine, perfectly clean flour also be brought with both private and public sacrifices. For a lamb, the measure of one aserin, for a ram, two, for a bull, three. This is consecrated on the altar kneaded with oil. For those who sacrifice also bring oil, for an ox, half a hin, for a ram, a third of that measure, and a fourth portion for a lamb. The hin is an ancient Hebrew measure equal to two Attic chos. The same measure of wine is brought as of oil, and the wine is poured out around the altar. If someone who is not performing a formal sacrifice brings fine flour in fulfillment of a vow, he casts one handful of it upon the altar as a first portion, and the priests take the rest for food, either boiled, since it has been mixed with oil, or made into loaves. But if a priest himself brings it, however small the amount, it must be burned whole. The law forbids sacrificing an animal on the same day together with its parent, and likewise forbids sacrificing any animal before the eighth day from its birth has passed. There are also other sacrifices offered for recovery from illness or for other reasons, at which cakes are consumed along with the victims. None of these may lawfully be left until the next day, the priests receiving their own portion. From the public funds, the law requires a lamb to be slaughtered every day, one at the beginning of the day and one at its close, of yearling animals, and on the seventh day, called the Sabbath, they sacrifice two in the same manner. At the new moon, they perform the daily sacrifices, and in addition, two bulls with seven yearling lambs and a ram, and a kid as atonement for sins, in case anything has been done through forgetfulness. In the seventh month, which the Macedonians call Hyperberetaios, in addition to what has been named, they sacrifice a bull, a ram, and seven lambs, and a kid for sins. On the tenth day of that same month, reckoned by the moon, they fast until evening. On this day they sacrifice a bull, two rams, seven lambs, and a kid for sins. In addition to these, they bring forward two more kids, of which one is sent alive into the wilderness beyond the borders, to be a means of averting and pleading away the sins of the whole people, while the other is led to a place outside the city, entirely pure, and burned there together with its hide, without being cleansed in any way at all. A bull is burned along with it as well, brought not at the people's expense, but supplied from the high priest's own means. Once it has been slaughtered, he carries its blood, together with that of the kid, into the sanctuary and sprinkles the ceiling with his finger seven times, and the floor the same number of times. Then he brings the rest into the sanctuary and around the golden altar, and finally around the greater altar in the open court. In addition, the projecting parts, the kidneys, and the fat together with the lobe of the liver are laid on the altar. The high priest also provides a ram as a whole burnt offering to God. On the 15th day of the same month, when the season turns at last toward winter, the law commands every household to pitch tabernacles, as a precaution against the cold as the year advances, and that when they have reached their own cities, coming to that city which they hold as their mother city because of the temple there, they should keep a festival for 8 days, offering whole burnt offerings and thank offerings to God, carrying in their hands a bouquet made of myrtle and willow bound with a palm frond, together with the fruit of the citron tree. On the first of these days, the whole burnt offering consists of 13 bulls, one more than the usual number of lambs, and two rams, with a kid added as atonement for sins. On the following days, the same number of lambs and rams is sacrificed along with the kid, but they reduce the bulls by one each day, so that they come down to seven. On the eighth day they rest from all work, and to God, as we have said, we sacrifice a calf, a ram, and seven lambs, and a kid as atonement for sins. This is the ancestral practice for Hebrews when they pitch the tabernacles. In the month of Xanthicus, which among us is called Nisan and is the beginning of the year, on the 14th day reckoned by the moon, when the sun stands in Aries. For in this month we were freed from slavery under the Egyptians, the sacrifice which we were commanded to offer at that time, as we were leaving Egypt, called the Passover, he ordained should be offered every year. And indeed we perform it by family groups, with none of the meat sacrificed kept over to the following day. On the 15th day, the Feast of Unleavened Bread succeeds the Passover, lasting 7 days, during which they live on unleavened food, and each day 2 bulls are slaughtered, 1 ram and 7 lambs. These are burned whole, with a kid added to all of them as atonement for sins, for the enjoyment of the priests each day. On the 2nd day of unleavened bread, that is, the 16th, they partake of the crops they have harvested, for they had not touched them before this. And considering it right to honor God first, from whom they have received this abundance, they bring him the first fruits of the barley in the following manner. Having parched a sheaf of the ears and pounded it, and cleaned the barley thoroughly for grinding, they offer an aseron of it to God upon the altar, and casting 1 handful of it forward, they release the rest for the priest's use. Only then is it permitted, publicly and privately, for everyone to reap. And at the offering of the first fruits of the crops, they also sacrifice a lamb as a whole burnt offering to God. When 7 full weeks have passed after this sacrifice, these being the 49 days of weeks, on the 50th day, which the Hebrews call Asartha, meaning 50th, they bring to God a loaf made from 2 aserins of wheat flour, leavened, and 2 lambs as victims. For these alone it is lawful to bring to God, while they are prepared as a meal for the priests, with nothing left over from them permitted until the next day. As whole burnt offerings they sacrifice 3 calves, 2 rams and 14 lambs, and 2 kids for sins. There is no festival on which they do not offer whole burnt offerings, and none on which they grant relief from these labors. Rather, in all of them, both the form of sacrifice and the ease of rest are prescribed by law, and they add feasting to their sacrifices. From the common fund, too, bread is baked without leaven, using 24 aserins of flour for this purpose. They are baked in pairs, divided on the day before the Sabbath, and brought early on the Sabbath itself, and set upon the sacred table, arranged 6 facing 6 toward one another. 2 golden dishes full of frankincense are placed above them, and they remain there until the following Sabbath. Then others are brought in their place, and the old loaves are given to the priests for food, while the frankincense is burned on the sacred fire, on which everything is offered whole, 1 portion of frankincense being added for those loaves, and another for these. The priest sacrifices at his own expense, and does this twice each day. Flour kneaded with oil and lightly baked, and set, 1 aserin of flour, half of which he offers to the fire in the morning, and the other half in the evening. I will explain this matter more precisely elsewhere. For now it seems to me enough to have spoken of it in this way. Moses set apart the tribe of Levi from association with the rest of the people, to be sacred, purifying them with running spring water and with the sacrifices which are lawfully offered on such occasions, and he handed over to them the tabernacle, the sacred vessels, and everything else that had been made for the tabernacle's protection, so that, under the guidance of the priests, they might serve, for it had already been consecrated to God. He also distinguished among the animals which they should eat and from which they should abstain. Concerning these, wherever occasion offers in the course of our narrative, we shall go through them, adding the reasons that moved him to command that some be food for us and others he ordered us to avoid. The use of any blood at all as food he forbade, holding it to be the soul and the breath of life. He also prevented the eating of meat from an animal that has died of itself, and forbade abstinence. Rather, he commanded abstinence from the fat and suet of goats, sheep, and cattle. He also drove out of the city those whose bodies were afflicted with leprosy and those suffering a discharge, and removed women during the natural discharge that comes upon them to the 7th day, after which he permits them, as now clean, to live among the community again. In the same way, it is lawful for those who have buried a corpse to return to the community after an equal number of days, but one who remains beyond that number of days, still bound by the defilement, must, by law, sacrifice 2 ewe lambs, one of which is to be consecrated whole, the other taken by the priests. In the same way, sacrifice is made also for one suffering a discharge. Whoever emits seed during sleep, by immersing himself in cold water, has the same standing as those who, according to the law, have had relations with a woman. Lepers he expelled entirely from the city, letting them share life with no one and reckoning them no different from the dead. But if someone, having entreated God, is released from the disease and recovers a healthy complexion, such a person repays God with various sacrifices, of which we shall speak later. For this reason, one might well laugh at those who say that Moses himself, disfigured by leprosy, fled from Egypt, and that, taking command of those who had been expelled for this same reason, he led them into Canaan. If this were true, Moses would hardly have made such laws to his own dishonor, laws which it would have been reasonable for him to oppose even had others proposed them, especially since among many nations lepers are found enjoying honor, not only free from insult and exile, but even serving in the most distinguished military campaigns, entrusted with political offices, and permitted to enter shrines and temples. So nothing would have prevented Moses too, had he or the multitude with him been diminished by some such affliction affecting the skin, from legislating the best possible provisions for them and fixing no such penalty at all. It is plain, then, that those who say such things about us are driven by malice, whereas Moses, being himself free of any such thing, legislated among his clean kinsmen concerning those who had fallen ill, doing this out of honor to God. But on these matters let each person judge as he thinks best. Women, once they have given birth, he forbade to enter the sanctuary or to touch the sacrifices for 40 days if the child born is male, for it happens that the days are doubled in the case of female births. When they do enter, after the aforesaid period has passed, they perform sacrifices, which the priests distribute before God. If a man suspects that his wife has committed adultery, he brings an aseron of ground barley. Casting one handful of it to God, they give the rest to the priests for food. One of the priests, having stood the woman at the gates, these face toward the sanctuary, and removed the covering from her head, writes the name of God on a piece of parchment and orders her to swear that she has done her husband no wrong, and that if she has transgressed her chastity, her right thigh shall be put out of joint and her belly swell, and so she shall die. But if it was through excessive love and the jealousy arising from it that the husband was rashly moved by suspicion, then in the 10th month she shall bear him a male child. When the oaths are completed, he wipes the name from the parchment into a bowl, and having brought in whatever dust he can find from the sanctuary and sprinkled it in, gives her the water to drink. If she was falsely accused, she becomes pregnant and carries the child to term in her womb. But if she lied to her husband concerning their marriage and to God concerning her oath, she ends her life in disgrace, her thigh dislocated and her belly seized with dropsy. Concerning sacrifices, then, and the purification connected with them, this is what Moses provided in advance for his kinsmen, and such were the laws he established for them. Adultery he forbade absolutely, holding it a blessing for men to be sound in their marriages, and that it benefits both cities and households for children to be legitimate. And for a man to have intercourse with his mother, the law pronounced the greatest of evils, likewise also with his fathers. A lawful wife, an aunt, a sister, or a son's wife, treating this as a monstrous injustice. He forbade a man to approach a woman defiled by her natural courses, and forbade intercourse with animals, and refused honor to the union of males with males, since men who pursue that pleasure hunt after it against nature and against the law. For those who dared such outrages, he fixed death as the penalty. On the priests, he imposed a purity twice as strict. He excluded them, like everyone else, from these unions. And beyond that, he forbade them to marry women who had practiced prostitution, or a slave, or a captive, or a woman who supported herself by keeping a shop or an inn, or a woman divorced from a former husband for any reason whatsoever. The high priest, moreover, he did not permit to marry even the widow of a man who had died a marriage he allowed to the ordinary priests, but granted him only the right to marry a virgin and to keep her so. For this reason, the high priest does not even approach a corpse, though the rest of the priests are not forbidden to attend their own brothers, parents, or children when they die. priests must be free of every physical blemish. A priest who is not whole in body may share in the priestly income, but is forbidden to mount the altar or enter the sanctuary. They must be pure not only in the performance of sacred rites, but must also take care over their manner of life generally, so that it too is beyond reproach. For this reason, those who wear the priestly robe are blameless and pure in every respect, and abstain from wine as long as they wear that robe, being forbidden to drink it. And further, the victims they sacrifice must be whole and marred in no part. These, then, are the regulations that Moses handed down as already in force during his own lifetime. But he also made provision, even while the people still lived in the wilderness, for what they were to do once they had taken possession of Canaan. Every seventh year, he grants the land respite from plow and planting, just as he had earlier prescribed rest from labor for men themselves every seventh day. Whatever the earth brings forth of itself in that year is to be common property, free for the use of anyone who wishes it, both kinsmen and foreigners, with no one laying up a private store from it. The same is to be done also after seven such weeks of years, 50 years in all, and this 50th year is called by the Hebrews the Jubilee, in which debtors are released from their loans and slaves are set free, at least those who are of the same nation and who, having transgressed some point of the law, were punished with the condition of slavery rather than with death. Fields, too, revert in this year to their original owners, in the following manner. When the Jubilee arrives, the name signifies liberty, the man who sold the plot and the man who bought it meet together. And after reckoning the produce taken from it and the expenses laid out upon it, if the produce is found to be the greater, the seller takes back the field, paying the buyer the balance. But if the expenses exceed the produce, the seller forfeits his claim to the property by paying only the amount by which they exceed it. And if produce and expenses are found to be equal, the field is simply restored to those who held it before. The same rule he wished to hold also for houses, so long as they had been sold in villages, for houses sold within a city he decreed otherwise. If the seller pays back the money before the year is complete, he compels the buyer to give up the house. But if the full year has elapsed, he confirms the buyer's ownership. This ordering of the laws Moses learned from God while he had the army encamped beneath Sinai, and he handed it down to the Hebrews in writing. When he judged that the arrangements concerning the legislation were satisfactorily settled, he turned next to reviewing the army, since he already had it in mind to take up military operations. And he ordered the heads of the tribes, except the tribe of Levi, to determine precisely the number of men able to bear arms, for the Levites were sacred and exempt from all such service. When the review was carried out, 603,650 men were found capable of bearing arms, ranging in age from 20 to 50. In place of Levi, Moses enrolled among the heads of the tribes Manasseh, son of Joseph, and Ephraim in place of Joseph himself. For it had been Jacob's request to Joseph that he give him these sons as if they were his own, as I have already related. When they pitched the tabernacle, it occupied the center, with three tribes encamping along each of its sides. Roads had been cut through the middle of the camp. Its arrangement was that of a marketplace. Everything for sale was set out in order, and craftsmen of every trade had their own workshops, so that it resembled nothing so much as a city that had picked itself up and settled elsewhere. The area around the tabernacle was occupied first by the priests, and next by the rest of the Levites, who numbered in all, for they too had been counted, every male 30 days old and upward 22,880. As long as the cloud remained standing over the tabernacle, they took this to mean that God was present among them and stayed where they were. When it moved on, they broke camp. Moses also devised a kind of trumpet, made of silver. It is fashioned as follows. It is a little short of a cubit in length, a narrow tube somewhat thicker than a flute, with an opening wide enough at the mouthpiece to admit the breath and flaring out at the end into a bell, much like a common trumpet. In the Hebrew tongue, it is called the hasasra. Two were made, and one of them was used to call the multitude together and summon them to assemblies. When it alone sounded, the elders were to gather to deliberate on matters concerning the community. When both sounded together, it gathered the whole people. When the tabernacle was to be moved, this was the procedure. At the first sounding, those encamped on the eastern side rose up. At the second, those stationed to the south did the same in turn. Then the tabernacle itself, taken down, was carried in the middle, with six of the advancing tribes ahead of it and six following, and the Levites were all gathered around it. At the third sounding, the section encamped toward the southwest set out, and at the fourth, the section toward the north. The trumpets were also used at the sacred rites, when the sacrifices were brought forward, and on Sabbaths and on the other festival days. It was then, for the first time since the departure from Egypt, that the Passover, so called, was sacrificed in the wilderness. After a short delay, he set out from Mount Sinai, and, passing through certain places which I shall describe, arrived at a spot called Esarimoth. There the people again began to rise up in faction, blaming Moses for what they had suffered on the journey, and complaining that, having persuaded them to leave a good land, he had cost them that land. While in its place, instead of the prosperity he had promised to provide, they now wandered amid these hardships, short of water, and should the manna also fail them, bound to perish utterly. While many spoke bitterly and harshly against the man, one among them urged the rest neither to forget Moses and all he had labored for their common safety, nor to despair of God's help. But the multitude was stirred all the more by this, and grew still more clamorous and violent against Moses. Moses, encouraging them though they were so utterly despondent, promised, though he had just been shamefully insulted by them, to provide them with meat in abundance, not for a single day, but for many. When they refused to believe this, and someone asked where he could possibly find such quantities for so many tens of thousands, he said, "God and I too, though maligned by you, will not cease laboring on your behalf, and this will come to pass before long." Even as he spoke, the whole camp was filled with quail, and the people gathered them, surrounding them on every side. Yet God was not long in taking vengeance on the Hebrews for their insolence and abuse toward him. No small number of them died, and to this day the place is still named for the event Kibroth Hattaavah, which might be rendered Graves of Craving. From there Moses led them to the place called Pharan, near the borders of the Canaanites and hard country to camp in. He gathered the people into an assembly, and standing before them said, "Since God has judged it right to grant us two blessings, freedom and possession of a prosperous land, you already have the one, given to you, and you are now about to receive the other. We sit upon the very borders of the Canaanites, and from now on nothing will hold back our advance, not a king, not a city, not even the whole of their nation gathered as one. Let us therefore prepare for the task, for they will not yield us the land without a fight, but only after being stripped of it in great struggles. Let us send out scouts, who will assess the excellence of this land and how great a force it commands. But above all, let us stand united, and hold God, who is our helper and ally in everything, in honor." When Moses had said this, the people repaid him with expressions of honor, and chose 12 scouts, the most respected men, one from each tribe. These traveled the length of Canaan from the borders of Egypt as far as the city of Hamath and Mount Lebanon. And after investigating the nature of the land, and of the people who lived in it, they returned after 40 days, having used the whole of that time for the task. They also brought back samples of the fruits the land produced, and by the beauty of these and the abundance of good things they described the land as having, they roused the people's eagerness for war. But at the same time, they frightened them by describing rivers impossible to cross for their size and depth, mountains impassable to travelers, and cities strong with walls and fortified enclosures, and they said that at Hebron they had come upon descendants of the giants. So the scouts, having seen things far greater than anything they had encountered since leaving Egypt, were themselves struck with terror over the state of Canaan, and tried to persuade the multitude to feel the same. The people, concluding from what they had heard that gaining possession of the land was hopeless, broke up from the assembly, and passed their time in lamentation together with their wives and children, protesting that God helped them in word only, not in deed. Again they blamed Moses, and cried out against him and against his brother Aaron the high priest, and spent the night uttering wicked reproaches, even against the men themselves. At dawn they ran together to the assembly, intent on stoning Moses and Aaron and then turning back to Egypt. Of the scouts, Joshua son of Nun, of the tribe of Ephraim, and Caleb of the tribe of Judah, took fright, and stepped forward into the midst of the crowd, urging the people to take courage and neither to condemn God of falsehood nor to trust those whose report about the Canaanites, spoken to terrify them, was untrue, but rather to trust those who urged them on toward prosperity and the possession of good things. Neither the size of the mountains, they said, nor the depth of the rivers would stand in the way of men who had practiced virtue, especially with God eagerly working alongside them and fighting on their behalf. Let us go, then, they said, against the enemy, harboring no suspicion, but trusting God as our leader and following those who guide us. With these words, they tried to soothe the people's anger, while Moses and Aaron fell to the ground and pleaded with God, not for their own safety, but that he would put an end to the people's folly and settle their minds, thrown into confusion by the helplessness of the calamity now confronting them. And the cloud appeared and stood over the tabernacle, signifying the presence of God. Moses, taking courage, came before the people and declared that God, moved to anger by their insolence, would take vengeance on them, not a vengeance equal to their sins, but of the kind that fathers inflict on their children for correction. For when he had gone into the tabernacle and wept over the destruction that threatened them, God had reminded him of all they had suffered at his hands and of the great benefits they had received from him, and how ungrateful they had proved toward him, and how now, led astray by the scout's cowardice, they had judged those men's words more trustworthy than his own promise. For this reason, he would not destroy them all, nor wipe out their nation, a nation he had honored above all others of mankind. Yet he would not grant them possession of the land of Canaan or the prosperity it offered. Instead, he would make them homeless and without a city to spend 40 years in the wilderness, paying this penalty for their transgression. To your children, however, he promised to give the land and to make them masters of the good things which you, through your own weakness, grudged yourselves the chance to share. When Moses had reported this, in keeping with God's judgment, the people fell into grief and misery and begged Moses to become their reconciler with God and freeing them from their wandering in the wilderness to grant them cities to live in. But he said that God would not entertain such a request, for God had not been provoked to anger against them by any human fickleness, but had passed judgment on them deliberately. And it should come as no surprise that Moses, a single man, could calm and turn to gentleness so many tens of thousands enraged as they were. For God, standing beside him, made the people yield to his words. And often, after disregarding them, they came to recognize through falling into disaster how unprofitable their disobedience had been. The man was remarkable for his virtue, and for the power of being believed concerning whatever he said, a power that did not belong only to the time in which he lived, but continues even now. For there is no Hebrew who does not, as though Moses himself were present and would punish him for disorder, obey the laws he established, even when he might act unlawfully and escape notice. And there are many other proofs of a power in him beyond that of an ordinary man. Indeed, even now some who dwell beyond the Euphrates, after a journey of 4 months' distance, have come out of honor for our temple, and after great dangers and expense, and after offering sacrifice, have not been able to partake of the offerings, Moses having forbidden it in the case of anyone who does not meet the conditions our ancestral customs require. Some of them offered sacrifice without partaking, while others, leaving their sacrifices half completed, and many, unable even to gain entry to the temple at all, went away obeying Moses' commands rather than preferring to act as they themselves wished, not out of fear of anyone who might call them to account, but only from wariness of their own conscience. Thus God's legislation, though it seems to be the work of a man, has caused that man to be regarded as greater than his own nature. Indeed, a little before this war, while Claudius was ruler of the Romans and Ismael was our high priest, a famine gripped our country, so severe that a measure of flour sold for 4 drachmas. When flour was brought in for the feast of unleavened bread amounting to 70 cores, these cores being 301 Sicilian medimni, or 41 attic, not one of the priests dared to eat a single grain of meal, though the land was in the grip of such distress, for fear of the law and of the wrath that the divine always holds against wrongs left unpunished. So one need not wonder at what was done in that earlier time, when even now the writings left behind by Moses carry such power that even those who hate us admit that the one who established our constitution is God, working through Moses and Moses' own virtue. But on these matters, let each judge as seems best to him.